tomorrow, partly sunny, a slight chance of some showers and storms late in the afternoon. Tomorrow's high 78. For Wednesday and Thursday, a slight chance of additional showers and storms during the afternoon hours. High both days around 81. Right now, sunshine and 61. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am pleased and honored to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Catherine Gerbner, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of Minnesota. And she has just released her first book, and it is a doozy. It is a book that explores a really fascinating topic that I think most of us have not taken sufficient time to really ponder. And that is the intersection between the Christian faith and slavery, and specifically as that played out in the so-called New World, and especially as it played out among Protestants. So were slaves allowed to convert to Christianity? If there was resistance to such a notion, what was at the heart of that resistance? Many questions surround this phenomenon, and what particular branches of Protestantism were particularly concerned with this issue. And she explores all of this and much more in her fascinating book, which is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, again titled Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. And it is an issue that not only involves specifically Christianity and slavery, but also helps us understand how we came to understand this notion of whiteness and of white supremacy actually springing out of some of these sort of ideological and theological debates that really raged throughout the New World in this particular period. I'm very grateful to Professor Gerbner for making time in her schedule to talk about her fascinating book. Professor Catherine Gerbner, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
I think it is really interesting that this book, in a sense, takes shape quite by accident, in the sense that you are actually exploring a related but very different topic, which actually ended up leading you down this path in what amounted eventually to this book. Explain to our listeners what your initial research was really all about, and then the surprising turn that it took.
You're right. I actually started researching anti-slavery thought and the origins of the abolitionist movement. And I was looking into the very first protest against slavery that was written in the American colonies, which was written in 1688 by a group of German and Dutch Quakers. And, you know, I thought this was a fascinating document, and it is an extremely important one. But what I found out as I did my research was that it was rejected even by other Quakers. And, you know, the Quakers are so heavily associated with abolition and anti-slavery that I didn't understand why this 1688 protest against slavery would have been rejected by English Quakers who were ruling sort of the Quaker community in Philadelphia.
And can I just ask, in what way was it rejected? In what sort of form did that rejection take, or in what manner did you even detect that it was rejected?
Well, so it was a petition. Basically, it was by a small Quaker meeting. And what the Quakers would do is that they would then send it on to the next more prominent meeting, and then it would be passed on. It was eventually passed on to the yearly meeting, which was the authoritative meeting in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. And there, it was discussed. You know, the proposal, which was basically to stop holding slaves and stop importing more enslaved people, it was discussed among the Quakers. And I mean, it was the actual quotation that was written onto the petition itself is that it was too weighty a matter to resolve at that time. And so it was basically shelved, and in Quakers continued to trade slaves, to hold slaves for nearly another 100 years. So it was quite literally, you know, rejected right there on the right there on the sheet of paper.
So it's a very official sort of rejection, and clear to you as you investigated this. And I suppose almost in an instant you realized that this story was far more complicated than you realized, just about anybody nowadays realized that there was a complicated story, and not just with the Quakers, but with other Protestants of this period.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So my research really began with the Quakers, and I began to look at the connections between, you know, Pennsylvania Quakers and then Quakers in the Caribbean, who almost all owned slaves, and started asking different questions. You know, why? How did they justify this? What did it mean to them? And then I expanded to other Protestant groups, the Church of England, the Anglicans, who were, you know, that this was sort of the most important Protestant denomination in the English colonies because it was the established church. And then another smaller Protestant denomination called the Moravians. Many people haven't heard of them today, but they were very important in this period, and especially for anyone who's interested in the relationship between slavery and Christianity. They were one of the most successful Protestant denominations in terms of actually converting people of African descent in the Caribbean.
So I guess that answers my question to some extent, which is why you chose in your book to focus in particular upon these three groups, the Anglicans, the Quakers, and the Moravians, although you certainly make at least brief mention of some other Protestant groups. And, of course, you also talk actually quite a lot about the Catholics. But maybe you could clarify even further why this story, in a sense, really coalesces around the Anglicans, Quakers, and Moravians more than any of these other groups. In a sense, why is this their story so much more sort of powerfully and centrally than some of these other groups?
Right. No, that's a really great question. And the answer is actually, it's pretty simple, which is these are the only three Protestant denominations that actually made an effort to try to convert enslaved people to Christianity in a systematic way in the early colonial period. So, you know, I decided I wanted to, you know, as I sort of researched the Quakers, I decided I wanted to think more deeply about this relationship between how Christianity was integrated into the slave system and this question of whether enslaved people were eligible for conversion to Protestantism. And the best way to look at that is really looking at missionaries who were trying to convert enslaved people. And these were the three Protestant denominations that were doing that. And so it was very clear to me that these were the most important groups to look at. And in the course of my research, I then, you know, looked at thousands and thousands of pages of records from each of these three different denominations to get a sense of the challenges that they encountered when they tried to convert slaves to Christianity, the arguments they made to slave owners to try to convince them to allow enslaved people to convert, and sort of the long-lasting effects of those arguments.
Mm. You make mention of the fact that that one of these groups in particular, I think it was the Moravians, were exceptional when it came to keeping a thorough and complete written record from this period. But of course, there's a rich treasure trove from all of these traditions and even beyond. I wonder if you could just spend a moment talking about the kind of written legacy that does exist, where you went to sort of search it out, and in general, the kind of legacy that was actually most valuable to you in sort of unlocking some of these complicated questions about this notion of Christian slavery.
Yes, well, this is one of my favorite things to talk about because, right, the sources, for a historian, the sources are everything. And sometimes, you know, we have questions that it is hard to get an answer to in the sources. So for me, you know, the question is trying to understand the perspectives of enslaved people who decided to join Christian congregations. You know, what were they thinking? What did it mean to them to be baptized? And so you find, you know, some answers here and there, but mostly, you know, our records are written by white missionaries or government officials. And so with the Quakers, you know, you have a lot of written records, but very little gives insight into the perspectives of enslaved people. And this is really the same with the Anglican Church. But the Moravians, as you mentioned, they are different. And part of it is that they're extremely prolific. I mean, there, when there's a missionary there, he is writing a diary every single day. If there are two missionaries, they're each writing diaries. And then in these Moravian records, I also found letters written by enslaved and free blacks themselves, which is extremely rare for this period and really an unparalleled opportunity to try to understand what Christianity meant to these men and women. And, you know, it's a surprise in many ways that they haven't really been written about before. And that's because the Moravians were writing in German. Many of the enslaved and free blacks were writing in Dutch Creole, which was the sort of the lingua franca of what's now the U.S. Virgin Islands, was then the Danish West Indies. So there's sort of a linguistic barrier to understanding them. And then many of them are actually held in a small town in eastern Germany called Herrnhut, which is where the headquarters of the Moravian Church are. And so, you know, before the end of the Cold War, it was actually pretty physically impossible to go there. And even since then, there are a lot of barriers to reading it because German written before the 1940s was written in a different script, and so you have to learn how to read the scripts. And so I already knew German, and then I found out about these records as I was doing my research, and I heard from other people that there were these really rich records, and if people knew German, they would be able to sort of unlock a new window into sort of everyday life for enslaved people in the Caribbean and early America. And so I was able to travel to Germany and read through these records on my own, and that is where some of the most exciting material that I found for my book comes from. You know, probably my favorite source is a letter that was written by a formerly enslaved but now free African woman in the island of St. Thomas.
This is the letter to the Queen of Denmark.
Yes.
Oh, amazing.
It's incredible. So this is a probably around she was about 70 years old. She'd been born in Africa, enslaved, transported to St. Thomas, where she, continued to practice her religion. She eventually met Moravian missionaries, found the Moravian congregation very appealing and decided to convert to Moravian Christianity. And, you know, then she found that the other white colonists on the islands, they were beating up and abusing the black Moravian converts because they didn't want them to convert to Christianity. They were stealing their Bibles and their reading material because they didn't want them to learn to read and write. And so she writes this petition to the Queen of Denmark, and it's on one side it's in her native West African language, which is probably Fon, and then on the other side it's in Dutch Creole, and it describes her experience, growing up in Africa, then coming to what she calls the land of the whites, and the fact that the white colonists are beating up the converts for trying to, praise the Lord Jesus and to learn how to read. So I just thought that this was a phenomenal source. It is from one woman to another woman across the ocean, and it really shows, it provides some perspective into what life was like for someone, her name was Marata, someone like Marata, and why she may have been interested in converting to Christianity. And it really, I think it upends many of the perceptions we have about the relationship between Christianity.
By the way, do we have any idea of whether or not this letter was read by the Queen of Denmark and or if it had any effect?
I don't actually know if it was ever read by the Queen of Denmark. I do know that it was read by other people in Europe, and I think it was intended to be sent to her, but then the Moravians eventually decided to sort of circulate it among their own circles. So it was read, but there's no reply as far as I know, and there was another letter written by a different group of enslaved and free converts written to the King of Denmark, and again, I don't believe that was ever answered, but the product itself is quite extraordinary.
Of course, and of immense value to you as a historian and to anybody else who wants to understand this period and particularly the experience of these slaves who had converted to Christianity and the cost that was involved to them.
Yes.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Catherine Gerbner, and we are talking about her book, Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. She explores the experience of slaves in the New World who converted under one circumstance or another to Christianity and the varying reasons for fierce resistance to the notion that slaves should be or could be permitted to convert to Christianity. There's so much to explore in this book. It examines this in remarkable detail. Professor Gerbner, I wonder if we could take a moment and step back just a little further in history. I think it would be helpful to our listeners if you could just give us kind of your perspective on, over the long view, the relationship between the Christian faith and slavery, and whether or not it has always been, in a sense, an uneasy relationship. I mean, uneasy in the same way that it certainly was in the New World in this period of time.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was always a little bit of an uneasy relationship, but not always as fraught as it became in sort of the early English colonies. If you look back sort of a couple millennia, you see that, when Christianity was sort of the religion of the Roman Empire and sort of in those sort of earlier years of the history of Christianity and slavery, they were pretty well reconciled. It was pretty common for a Christian to own another Christian, and in fact, there were Christian monasteries that they had Christian slaves who were sort of worked for the monastery, and so it starts off, more or less reconciled. But at the same time, there are instances of a Christian slave owner deciding to manumit or free a Christian slave because of, you know, their feelings of piety. So there's a connection between freeing someone and being a Christian, but it's not mandatory. Over time, things change. You know, when you get to the kind of the medieval period, and especially in southern Europe, where there's basically ongoing fights with Muslim Spain and North Africa, there is a change in the ethic around slavery and slaveholding. So it eventually becomes pretty taboo to own another Christian, but it's fine to own a Muslim and to enslave a Muslim. And the rationale is is pretty implicit. If you can enslave someone who's not of your religion, and the hope is that they will then convert to Christianity. So by about 1300, 1400, it's no longer really okay to enslave other Christians, but it's fine to enslave, quote-unquote, infidels or heathens. And this is the same in northwestern Europe, where slavery doesn't really exist as much because, there's sort of been the rise of the feudal or manorial system where labor is tied to the land instead of having chattel slavery where a person can be moved and sold. But, people in England and what's now, the Netherlands, they still believe that slavery could be just and slavery was fine as long as you didn't enslave another Christian. And so, again, you have slavery is compatible with Christianity, but you're now not supposed to own another Christian. When the sort of the next stage is when the Spanish and the Portuguese they're the first European powers to begin to colonize the New World, and they also are the Portuguese are the one who begin to transport enslaved Africans to the Atlantic Islands and then to the Americas. And there you see the relationship between Christianity and slavery evolve yet again. The Pope comes in and basically says it's fine to enslave people as long as you then baptize them. And so in the Catholic colonies, your slavery and Christianity, or really Catholicism and slavery, are reconciled in a way. Of course, it's always still, there are always still debates going on about this. But you're supposed to baptize an enslaved person as soon as you enslave them. So you can enslave them because they're not Christian, but once they are enslaved, you should baptize them and bring them into the Catholic community. And then when the Protestant nations of England and the Netherlands begin to participate in the African slave trade and to colonize in the Americas, then they think about things differently, and part of this is because Protestant baptism has been such a contentious issue within the Reformation. Protestants disagree about when someone can be baptized, whether you can even baptize an infant, or whether someone has to wait until they're an adult. And so in the Protestant colonies, what ends up happening is that enslaved people, even though the justification for enslaving someone is that they're not Christian, and then the implication is that you will then sort of convert them to Christianity, what ends up happening is that Protestant slave owners, they think that Protestantism is equated with freedom, and they do not want enslaved people to become Christian, and so they actually prevent enslaved people in the vast majority of cases from accessing Protestant baptism. And so it is a very long and complicated history, sort of this relationship between Christianity and slavery, but you see it evolves quite differently. And in the English colonies, it evolves in a way in which Protestantism is aligned very closely with being a free person, in many cases being a slave owner. And as a result, white slave owners or Protestant slave owners do not want enslaved people to become Christian.
That just seems like a dangerous line to cross.
Yes, absolutely.
To say the least. You tell us in the book that there is, for instance, in Barbados, at some point in the 17th century, some sort of slave code of conduct that kind of lays out the way things should be done, that very specifically makes a difference between the Christian slaveholder and the Negro slave, and where it's not that whites own the blacks, it's that Christians are owning these Negro slaves. And the implication almost seems to be at this point in time that you're a slave owner because you're a Christian. I mean, or because you are a Christian, it's okay to be a slave owner. And it made me wonder, among many things, what about when a slave owner was not a Christian? I mean, did not embrace the Christian faith. Was that, in a sense, all but unheard of in this period? I mean, even if someone did not, maybe on a more personal level, profess to actually believe the tenets of the Christian faith, were they at least in sort of an official sense, at least in name, a Christian? I mean, is that just the way it had to be done in this time and place?
Well, you know, there actually, on Barbados, there were also Jewish slave owners. So there were slave owners who were, you know, not Christian. They were the minority. But I think that they were sort of seen as an exception, and, you know, they also were not granted full rights of, you know, citizenship within the Barbadian society. I think for the most part, though, yeah, you are absolutely right that sort of the word Christian becomes a replacement for a free person who can be a slave owner. And it is the fundamental, it is sort of in the legal codes and in sort of the vernacular of the society, Christian almost becomes code word for free. And so you see how religious difference really, it becomes the fundamental way that the line between freedom and slavery is being policed by slave owners. So, you know, Christianity then sort of, and especially Protestantism, takes on this new meaning within this context where it is now kind of legally the underpinning of slavery and the justification for slavery.
Fascinating. As we've already talked about, there was intense resistance from probably most slave owners of this period to allow their slaves to convert. And so this would set up a very tense situation when a missionary might come on the scene with the intention of perhaps converting some of these slaves to Christianity. Can you help us understand the circumstances under which a missionary might sort of enter the scene? I mean, do we know very much about, in a sense, where they would go, how they would go about doing this? Would it be right in plain view of the slave owners, or was this something that had to be done by stealth, or did it depend according to each particular slave owner and their own attitudes? I mean, how would missionaries navigate this and go about trying to do the work that they had always done in this place where their efforts would not be welcome?
Right, it's a great question, and really it depended a lot on the missionary and their particular first of all their denomination, how they would define their approach in part, and then also sort of people took individual tact. So there was an Anglican missionary in South Carolina, Francis Legeau, who basically his approach was to try. He would always have to get the the clearance from a slave owner before he would agree to catechize an enslaved person. And so, you know, his diaries are filled with these frustrations that slave owners are, no matter how much that he tries to reassure them that, you know, a Christian slave would be a more obedient slave, he just has a very hard time trying to convince these white slave owners to allow him to have access to enslaved people and to catechize them. With someone like George Fox, who is literally one of the very first missionaries, he was the founder of Quakerism. You know, he comes to Barbados in the 1670s, not intending to convert enslaved people to Christianity, but really to visit the, you know, English Quakers on the islands. But what he ends up seeing is, you know, he sees that enslaved people were excluded from Quaker communities and from Anglican churches. And so he then, you know, says that Quakers should, you know, include enslaved people in their meetings, allow them to have their own worship meetings. And there, what you see is that Quakers are operating sort of at odds with the English colonial governments, and they get in great trouble. There's actually an act passed in 1676 against the Quakers because the Quakers were allowing enslaved people to meet for worship, and this was seen as a threat of rebellion because, you know, basically what the white colonists saw was just a lot of enslaved people congregating together, and they're, you know, these are paranoid, absolutely fearful societies where any sort of indication of collaboration or meeting among an enslaved group of people, you know, triggered fears of slave revolt. So really it depended on the colony. Quakers were very confrontational and antagonistic towards Anglicans, so that is sort of how the missionary process played out in that context. But then Anglican missionaries tried to be a lot more accommodationist towards slave owners. But in the end, you know, some of them still ended up going behind the backs of slave owners because they just met so much resistance. And so, you know, there's another missionary in colonial New York who would, he would congregate Elias Noy, and then he would have enslaved people congregate in his home. And oftentimes it was at night. There is definitely read in the records that some of them came without the permission of their owners. So again, it just depended on the missionary, you know, how much risk was he willing to take on, and how much was he going to try to work with slave owners as opposed to just trying to, you know, congregate and worship with enslaved people.
Hmm. And of course, we have plenty of instances in which missionaries themselves are physically beaten for doing and facing that kind of retribution. I think this is a really important moment for us to talk about the term conversion. And in your book, you spend some time with this term and really help us understand that it is a shame if we are too simplistic about this term within this context. That the question of what did it mean for a slave to convert to Christianity, that could really take a number of different forms. And in some cases, it might be what we might more classically think of it as a conversion. I mean, like the lightning bolt that strikes Saul and has a change of heart and sees the world differently and comes to believe, versus a conversion that, in a sense, is all but forced on a person, or a conversion that, in fact, is a decision one makes maybe for very practical reasons and so on. I mean, this whole notion of conversion is incredibly complicated within this context. Help us understand kind of the best way for us to untangle this particular complexity.
Yes, thank you for that question, because it's true that today we have this perception of conversion as, you know, right, a change of heart, or, you know, you have this sudden realization, you turn away from, you know, the one faith and you turn towards one, another, you know, the new faith. And, you know, that type of conversion developed in the 18th century, really. It's a legacy of evangelical conversion narratives. And if you look at the 17th century and this period that I'm looking at, conversion was a very complex, I mean, it's still a complex thing, but it was it could mean a lot of different things. And so we have to remind ourselves that to convert to Protestant Christianity during this time, you know, it meant sort of, first of all, that it was a claim to political power, right, because you had to be a Protestant in many cases to vote or to hold office. Secondly, It really was a very important way to learn how to become literate. So missionaries often taught enslaved people how to read and write, and this was an opportunity that they would not encounter elsewhere. And so Protestant conversion was very closely associated with education. And so someone who decided to convert to Christianity, this was oftentimes one of the primary reasons that he or she wanted to, you know, engage with the missionary and become part of a Moravian or Anglican or Quaker congregation. Then, you know, theology also could play a really important role. Different missionaries would emphasize different aspects of Christian theology that could be more or less sort of interesting and intriguing to enslaved and free blacks. And then finally, socially, conversion meant that you were part of this new community. And missionary congregations and later black churches, they play an absolutely central role in, you know, supporting other enslaved and free blacks, providing a sense of solace and community in a world that was, you know, frankly, just a harsh, brutal world. So I think that we have to understand that conversion itself has changed over time, and we have to think about what it meant to the people who were choosing to convert, and to understand conversion through their eyes instead of imposing our perception of conversion as this change of heart onto people in the past.
We're speaking with Catherine Gerbner, who is author of this endlessly fascinating new book called Christian Slavery: Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. I believe you yourself have coined the term Protestant supremacy. I'm not sure we've actually raised that term yet in this interview. And of course, it is really important for us to understand this concept, which I think for you, in a sense, gathers together the various reasons for this bias against conversion of slaves. And of course, then we talk from there about what this notion of Protestant supremacy leads to. But let's talk first about what is wrapped up in that term of Protestant supremacy. And am I right that that's your term?
Yes, that's right. It took me several years, just picking up this, realizing that slave owners were so violently averse to allowing enslaved people to convert to Christianity. First, I just didn't understand it, and then I began to see that really religious difference was the way that enslavement and oppression were justified, and that it was in the law books. I mean, that it was an entire ideology, and so that I felt like this needed to be named, and so I called it Protestant supremacy. Because what I argue is that this is the forerunner of white supremacy. So white supremacy, which we're all familiar with today, it uses race to create and justify inequality, and Protestant supremacy uses religion. And so we sort of talked a little bit about the first slave law in the English colonies. Right? We talked about how colonists, they didn't use the word white. That didn't exist as a racial term at that point, and instead they called themselves Christian. And so this shows us how important religious difference was for the creation, the legal justification for enslavement and oppression. And this, I think, is wrapped up I think that the term Protestant supremacy describes that complex of ideas and the combination of sort of a legal framework with a theological foundation, with the social practice of slavery. And I think it's really important to recognize how what would later become white supremacy really had its roots in a religious justification, which was Protestant supremacy.
So explain how that shift eventually occurred, where in a sense the supreme position or rights of the slaveholder became in a sense unbundled from matters of religion and became more a matter of race. And over what kind of a period of time did that occur? And did that occur with the pen on paper, I mean, in terms of official documents, or was it more a shift of understanding and sentiment?
Right. Well, I love this term, unbundled. And yes, it did. It was absolutely, you can see it in the legal documents. In 1650, there's really no reference to whiteness in the law books. By 1700, that has changed. And so one of the questions I was asking was, you know, what happened? Why did people suddenly start calling themselves white instead of Christian, which is what they had been calling themselves before? And what I found is that, you know, in 1650, this is sort of the slave system is just getting going in the American colonies in the Caribbean. And religious difference is the justification for slavery. And as we've talked about already, slave owners, as a result, don't want enslaved people to convert to Christianity. Eventually, missionaries arrive, and also enslaved people recognize, you know, these are smart people. They see that Protestantism, Christianity, that these are important indicators of political power and social power within the society. Many are also curious about the theology of Christianity. And so a very, very small minority, an important minority, but a small minority, are able to somehow fight their way into Protestant churches, gain baptism. Some of them are able to win freedom somehow. And so by the 1690s, you have a small but noticeable community of free black Christian people in places like Barbados. And they are an implicit threat to this ideology of Protestant supremacy, right? Because they have all of these markers of, you know, what one needs to be a person who can vote and hold office. And so it's at this very time that slave-owning lawmakers introduce the word white, and they do so in order to change the prerequisites for voting. They do that first in 1697, where they say, instead of just having to be a Christian man who owns property and is 21, which are the normal prerequisites for voting in the English colonies, now you have to be a white Christian man who owns property and is 21. And so you see that it is because black people have recognized the power of Protestantism and have converted to Protestantism, you know, fought their way into churches, that, you know, as soon as they do that, slave-owning lawmakers then create a new barrier, and that barrier is whiteness. And whiteness and the concept of race, that really becomes the long-lasting legacy of this period of slavery. And obviously it is sort of, it's still central to our society today because it was very, very effective. And, you know, over time, the concept of whiteness was also changed and adjusted. So, you know, in 1697 is the first law saying that you have to be white in order to vote. 12 years later, lawmakers come back and they define whiteness even more specifically, and they say you can't have a single drop of African blood in order to qualify as white. So what you can see here, sort of reflected in the laws, is that mixed race people who are Christian had advocated for themselves and said that, well, they had a white parent and therefore they should be able to vote. And this law came in order to specifically exclude them from the privileges of whiteness. And so that is really the current definition of whiteness in this country is based on this quote-unquote one-drop rule.
Wow. So in other words, what had been the breakdown for centuries, that matter of Christian slave owners owning heathen slaves, that becomes an untenable framework because we have more and more slaves that one way or another are managing to convert and no longer can be called heathen with any clear conscience by those who want to keep them suppressed as slaves. And so then this notion of whiteness is in a sense created to reestablish that barrier, in a sense, between slave owner and slave.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I mean, and I think it's so important to realize that it was intentional, that this wasn't just something that happened to evolve, that this was something that lawmakers at the time, slave-owning lawmakers, they, you know, they were not dumb. Again, they see that there's this new population of free black Christians. They know what they want, and this was a specific way to exclude them from political power and from social power.
This was a very conscious move done for self-gain and self-protection.
Yes, exactly.
A last question. One of the things that is most intriguing about your book and the way that you explore this topic is that this is a complicated question then as now, although I mean, in some ways it's not as complicated a question now. I mean, I think now any civilized person sees the utter wrongness of slavery in a way that maybe was not seen by everybody several hundred years ago. But certainly back then there was plenty of wrestling with this whole notion and lots of strong difference of opinion over these questions and differences between various groups and so on. I wonder if, as you have read so much of the writing from this period, if your sense is that the difference of opinion was, in a sense, cleaner between these people over here that believe this and these people over there that believe this versus people even within themselves being divided over this kind of an issue. I mean, by and large, do you think people were either A or B in this period, or were there plenty of people who themselves were, in a sense, philosophically and ideologically divided over this issue? Does that question make sense?
It does. And, you know, I think that people were very complicated, and they were often divided in their, you know, in their own sort of minds about this question of the whether, especially whether, you know, enslaved people could become Christian. One of the things that I trace in the book is that, you know, you have this rhetoric which seems so decisive one way or the other, and the rhetoric often does not match with the reality of how people act. And so there are slave owners who will say, don't allow any enslaved people to become Christian, they will rebel and cut our throats. And at the same time, they have a good relationship with one or two enslaved people on their plantation or in their households, and they act differently with them, and they say, oh, well, this person is the exception. And so I think that there was a great deal of wrestling, you know, that people did in their own minds, and also a way in which people said one thing and did another. And I think that that is, frankly, just human nature. You know, we are complicated people. And people in the past were just as complicated as we are today. And sometimes it's hard to really remember that and really take that seriously. But I think it's important to, if we want to learn from the past, because, you know, we all think, oh, well, we, you know, if we were living in 1650, we never would have supported slavery. You know, I think that it's harder. We need to be serious about what the stakes were for people. And how hard it is to actually, in reality, fight against an oppressive system, even when you sort of recognize that it's oppressive, but you're also kind of gaining from it. So, you know, it absolutely was extremely complicated, and the issue was never black and white.
Hmm. I appreciate that you do not shy away from the complexities, and that's one of the things that makes your book so incredibly fascinating and revelatory. The book, again, is Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World, published by University of Pennsylvania Press. The author, Catherine Gerbner. Professor Gerbner, I have really enjoyed reading your book and very much enjoyed this conversation as well. Thank you so much and best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Doug Instanis looks back on his 25 years with the Racine Theater Guild. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackanddrea.com.
Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.